Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. I'm Matt Beadle and I'm with a man who, in a 14-year career as a professional goalkeeper, would celebrate saving penalties by doing a forward roll. It's Richard Lee.
Is there any other way to celebrate a penalty?
I don't know, mate. You tell me.
Well, you could just do the normal fist pump, but a quality forward roll. You don't see that these days.
I've got to say, that was in last week's podcast. That was just going to be one story, done, move on. But you added a layer to that story with the revelation that Newcastle keeper Steve Harper mocked you mid-penalty shootout.
And you have since made contact with Steve Harper, I believe.
We have, yeah. There has been words. So this story will run and run.
Fantastic news.
Plenty coming up again this week. Rich will be dissecting all the weekend's action. We'll be talking to a very special guest. And we'll even sneak in a little cheeky glove review this week, Rich.
Fantastic times. I'm excited. And I've actually seen the gloves and I am excited. Okay. I won't give too much away just yet.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search GK Union. Alternatively, send us absolutely anything you like, preferably goalkeeper related, to hello@goalkeepersunion.net. We're going to start with Fulham. We talked a lot about Fulham last week. This week, another couple of goals shipped. Sergio Rico came in.
Yeah, three goals again. They're keeping up this ratio of almost three goals a game so far, which 10 games into the season. It's been tough for the goalkeepers. And I felt for Bettinelli, the fact that he got dropped seemed a bit odd to me, especially after him signing a new contract only a couple of days before the game. And he hasn't been at fault. As far as I've seen, he hasn't been at fault for any of the goals. Defensively, Fulham are a mess at the moment. They've decided to drop Bettinelli, brought in Sergio Rico. Again, not a great deal he could have done about the goals. There was one that went through his legs that he went down slightly in an unorthodox fashion, where he's gone down almost on his knees rather than producing a long barrier or trying to do a K-shape to spread. He may have spread slightly better on that goal. But other than that, not a lot he could have done about the goals. Made a nice save with his top hand up to his right in the top corner. Needed a firm left hand to push it around the post. And all in all, did okay. But I think it's interesting that Jukanovic has decided to drop Bettinelli and almost use that as one of the changes he's making to try and shore up this defence. Where, look, looking from a goalkeeper's perspective, goalkeeping is not the problem at Fulham at the moment. The problem is further up the pitch. The problem is with the style of play, not to do with Bettinelli, not to do with Sergio Rico. In fact, it's the third goalkeeper they've tried this season.
Which 10 is games in.
10 games in. I don't know any other Premier League team that have ever tried three goalkeepers 10 games in. And I do worry for Fulham and for the goalkeepers. And it's tough. I've been in teams before where, and I give this example, it's law of averages. I saw recently that Man City have only conceded, I think it's 10 or 11 shots. So they might have only conceded three goals, but Fulham are conceding 10 or 11 shots per game. So of course, the goalkeepers are going to concede more goals. Just pure law of averages. Of course, they're going to make more mistakes. They're also going to make more saves. So I am concerned for Fulham goalkeepers. It's going to be very difficult to shine in that team this season.
It's interesting you mentioned the three goalkeepers and whether many teams have ever done that. There's been a lot of comparisons to Derby, that infamous Derby team from the 2007-08 season. They did a similar thing. They shared the goalkeeping between three. Stephen Bywater was in there, played the majority of the games, but they shared it out. Mm. Does it unsettle teams if you keep changing your goalkeeper?
Yeah, I think it's not just goalkeeper. I think it's all over the pitch. I remember that season because I think there's Lewis Price as well, if I remember rightly. You're right. I think that, look, he needs to make a decision and stick with it. Why it's taken this many games to give Sergio Rico his chance, I have no idea. They got rid of their goalkeeper coach as well when Bettinelli was initially given his chance. I don't exactly know what happened behind the scenes there, but it just seems odd that he's made that change, especially given how well Bettinelli did last season. You know, he came in middle of the season. They went on that 20-game unbeaten run. He's established himself. He's got his England call-up. He signed his new contract. It just seemed like an odd decision to make at an odd time. I appreciate that he needs to make changes and find a way to shore up that defence, but changing goalkeeper is not always the way in which you do that.
You talked about his technique on that second goal. Mm. To the untrained eye, as it were, it looks like a straightforward goal. He slid out. It's gone through his legs. Is that one of the hardest strikes for a keeper to stop? One of those that skids through the middle of the legs?
Yes and no. First and foremost, it's not a goalkeeping mistake. Could he have done better? Possibly. And the reason I say that is what you look at is point of impact. So if you were to pause the screen the moment that the strikers hit the shot, you would then see how big is the goalkeeper, how much of his body is he able to make the save with. So you, if you consider that if the body's slightly twisted and you create what's called a long barrier, and you've got your knee down, your foot down, your arms by your side, you're making a shape that is the biggest possible barrier you can make in order to make the save. Unfortunately for him, when the ball was struck, if you pause the screen and you see where he is, the barrier's not big. He's literally, if he saves it with his knees or his legs, that's about all he can save it with. And sometimes you get away with it, sometimes you make the save. In this case, he didn't. So the only question mark would be, could you have made yourself slightly bigger at point of impact? Now, this is where football's changed. It wasn't so long ago that Peter Schmeichel, his technique was to run out, charge out, and throw himself at the striker. What's happened over the years is that the strikers have got cleverer in their movements and in the way in which they finish. How many times do we see that little dink over a keeper? They seem to have perfected it now, where they're one-on-one. It's just a little chip. I think Mane did one, I think, yesterday as well. That lovely little chip. So you can't run out and dive at a striker anymore because you will get beaten more often than not. So this option that most are going for now is De Gea does it very well. This where they spread their body in a really effective way. So you've got three choices. One, you're waiting for that shot and you might stay deep. And if they shoot early, you're ready. Two, you get to the ball before the striker gets to the ball. You get there and you smother it. And that's a fantastic position if you can do that. Three, if you can't quite do that, get as close as you possibly can and make yourself as big as you possibly can.
I've got a slight issue with the Mane one that you're talking about there, because when I said it seems a bit blasé for a keeper, Etheridge came out, it was almost looked like he was resigned to the fact that he was beaten. He slid out, and it was an easy goal for Mane. Yes, it was a delicate chip, but it was, and look, there's an element of skill in that. Of course there is. But it just looked like it was too easy for Mane to dink that over him.
Well, that's where we talk. I would say that Etheridge has gone with a very similar technique to what Peter Schmeichel did. Now, Peter Schmeichel was fantastic at what he did back in the day. I think that he was the catalyst for a lot of strikers trying to think, you almost think, how do I beat a Peter Schmeichel? When you've got someone 6'5" running out and throwing themselves at you, how do you beat them? Joe Hart does it brilliantly. So of course, like, it's cat and mouse. As soon as goalkeepers are doing that, strikers then need to find the antidote. What is it we do in order to beat a goalkeeper that runs and throws themselves at us? So that then is where this little dink came in. That's where they might go round the goalkeeper and look to finish. Neil Etheridge, you're right, in the game, he did. He came out arguably a little bit too quick. He spread himself, tried to make the same. Mane, it's a great finish, fantastic finish, but that might be where this third option we're talking about comes in. Next time, he might come out, stop, and look to spread while he's still stood up, which might give him the chance to get a hand up if Mane does the same finish, or Mane then might be forced into a different type of finish because he doesn't make his mind up for him.
Okay, let's chat about Watford and Jonas Lersel, the Huddersfield keeper. I'm going to bring up an outfield player's opinion here, mate. Match of the day, Jermaine Genus said, "I'd be very disappointed with my keeper if a goal went in from that angle." He's referring to Gerard Deulofeu's goal against Jonas Lersel, where he cut on the outside and whipped it in, went in on the near post.
Yeah, and I get it. When it's an angle as tight as that, naturally you're going to look at the goalkeeper and think you shouldn't be beaten at that angle. It's kind of reminiscent of the famous Giggs against Seaman goal. If you remember the FA Cup semi-final, Giggs cuts in from a tight angle and smashes it into the roof of the net. Now, there's two differences. A few people did criticise Seaman for that. Now, could the goalkeeper have done slightly better? Possibly. The difference with the Deulofeu strike is the trajectory of the strike. As he strikes it, it starts off very high and actually dips. Now, more often than not, when someone's striking it and they're that close to you, as a goalkeeper, you're taught to bend over a little bit more because the chances are it's going to come on the floor. The chances are it's going to go in a corner. You want to get down as quick as you possibly can to make the save. It's very rare you face a strike like that that starts quite high, actually goes in above his head and then dips over him in order to go into the goal. And it looks like it beats him very easily. The only way in which he can save that is by standing up a little bit more, but then he becomes susceptible to the one that might go in by his feet. So you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. So do I think of it being a mistake? Not really. I think it's a fantastic finish more than a goalkeeping error. It's the same with a lot of goals. The goalkeeper might have done something different in order to make the save, but by doing that thing different, he might concede more goals further down the line because the technique isn't correct for that position. I actually think when you come in on that angle and they're within 5 or 6 yards, the technique was okay. The only other thing he might have done is narrow the angle. If it had narrowed the angle slightly, then it would have been more difficult. He probably would have made the save, but then by doing that, Deulofeu then might cut it back and suddenly someone's got an empty goal and then we're criticising him for leaving his goal. So it's difficult. There's lots of different decisions you've got. Again, I don't think it's a mistake. I think 9 times out of 10, he makes a save from that angle. I think we need to give credit to Deulofeu for a fantastic strike.
At the other end of the pitch, Ben Foster. Now, I know we talk about Ben Foster quite a lot on this show. He is your mate, but another great performance.
Yeah, look, for me, and I am biased, he's a friend, but he gets better with age. He's 35, turning 36. He looks stronger than he's ever looked. And I remember him back in the day when we worked together. He won't mind me saying this. He wasn't the most professional. Always had a little belly on him, a little bit overweight. Didn't like training. You know, he loved playing games. And he was quite sloppy in a lot of what he did. To the point, and this is a true story, one game, I remember, I think it was Tottenham at home, and he turned up. We had to report at midday for pre-match. He turned up at like 1:45. And the reason was he overslept. Like, amazing that somebody can oversleep for a Premier League game. But then he goes out and gets man of the match. And that sums him up. He's happy-go-lucky to an extent, but he does work hard. And he's got fitter and fitter with age. He now, for people that know him, he cycles a lot. Body fat is next to nothing now. He's so powerful in his movements. And in this game, two saves in particular. The first one that got the standard good save from Foster. It was an absolutely fantastic save he made. Again, the flight of the ball, the trajectory of the ball, it's going over him. It's dipping under the bar. And how he's got the spring to get fingertips to tip it onto the bar is beyond me. Brilliant save. And then another one from distance into the top corner. Two quick steps. A lot of young goalkeepers listen to this. You'll hear a coach say a lot, you need to get a quick step in before you dive. And he did. He got two quick steps, sprung into the top corner, put it round the post. And in the end, it looks like a comfortable victory for Watford. But it wasn't. If one of those goes in, it's a completely different game. And in the end, Ben Foster, for me, was the match winner.
Brighton and Mr. Matt Ryan. Kind of goes under the radar in terms of Premier League goalkeepers, Matt Ryan. But another clean sheet.
And another big victory for Brighton. They keep picking up these victories. And he's been a key part of what they've done over the last 18 months. He, for me, is the model of consistency. You know, I watch him, very few errors. He's one of those keepers that is strong in all areas without necessarily having something you say he was outstanding at. He is the for me, the Brad Friedel type character. You know what you're going to get from a Matt Ryan. And for Brighton, I'm sure Brighton fans will agree, he's been a phenomenon since they brought him in last season. And he continues to get better and better. And he's a winner. You can see the way in which he plays. And he's done it certainly over the last season or so. He plays to win and he finds a way to win. And you talk about goalkeepers making big saves at big moments. Now, this is one of the, in to some extent, it's a myth. Because, of course, you can only do what comes to you. You can't create a save out of nothing. You need the opposition to do something. But there is something about that. Certain keepers seem to make saves at important times, whereas others don't. Not necessarily that one's a mistake and one's not, but I do believe there's something to that. There's certain types of characters that make big saves when it matters. And for me, Matt Ryan's one of those characters.
Only just over 6 foot as well, Matt Ryan. So not massive, not a huge, stereotypically giant keeper.
It's one of the reasons I like him so much. No, you're right. He's not. He's not huge. And I love the fact that we're seeing the likes of him and Jordan Pickford are now starting to prove that you don't need to be 6'4", 6'5", in order to be a goalkeeper. The difference in height between someone who's 6'1" and 6'5", it's not going to make that much difference when it comes to shot stopping. It's not going to be the case that the 6'1" goalkeeper is letting in goals comfortably or not able to come to crosses. If anything, I would argue that 6'2" is the perfect height for a goalkeeper. And I've said that for a long time. When you consider that, I think it's 80% of the shots are low, then if you're that little bit smaller, you could argue that you're going to get down that little bit quicker. If you're 6'7", 6'8", it's going to be that much harder to get down lower than it is to get into the top corners, etc. So, look, it's great to see that Pickford's doing what he's doing. It's great to see that Matt Ryan's doing what he's doing too.
There was another incident in that game, and actually I saw this midweek in the Champions League, Inter versus Barca. Now, Brozovic laid down behind the wall and he stopped Luis Suarez from scoring a free kick. Now, it was almost going to be a certain goal. The wall was there, the bank of four or five, but Brozovic was laid behind the wall, goalkeeper facing. Now, I'm presuming, obviously, the way it worked out, the ball went underneath the wall. It's just a bizarre way of defending a free kick.
Things are evolving. You know, that technique, we've seen so many now that have fired it low and it's gone in that corner. And so teams are adapting. They're trying to find ways to counteract that, of course. I've seen it lately that the building of walls, like, it's something that people don't consider that often as to how important it is. For a goalkeeper, you need to get your wall right. The general consensus when it comes to a free kick against is that you set yourself up just slightly to one side of the goal. You have the wall the other side. Now, you should not get beaten on your side, first and foremost. If someone's going to score a goal against you, they need to go up and down over the wall. And you'd ordinarily put your bigger players in the wall, of course. So they're likely to have to get it up 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot if the wall's jumping. Up, down, over the wall, into the top corner. If you do that, I'll give you the goal. Other than that, you do not score. Now, lately, what I've seen is walls that have been misplaced only marginally. But if you do that, it makes it very easy for a talented player to whip it round the wall. And of course, if you're slightly over to one side, you're not going to get there. And that's bad goalkeeping. Okay, that's something, and I've seen it a few times recently, where goalkeepers have not lined their wall up correctly. Now, whether they have someone lie down or not, if you do, then your wall needs to jump. They need to jump a couple of foot. You have someone lying behind. Now, all of a sudden, you've got an 8 foot wall. It's going to be so difficult for someone to get it up, down, over. And if you're covering your side like you should, then it's going to make it even more difficult for even the most talented player to get it up and down over an 8 foot wall and score a goal.
Jordan Pickford again stopped a penalty. This time it went in with the follow-up, but a decent performance.
He was excellent. Again, really, really good. He's looking sharper and sharper with each game. A very good penalty save. It was actually only the fact that Pogba's penalty was so poor that he ended up getting the rebound. Because Pickford, as you would, if you're going to dive, my advice is always to dive full out. You know, don't. There's nothing worse, and every goalkeeper will have felt this, when you dive and you miss it by an inch or two and you realise that had you just given a little bit more to the dive, you would have made the save. Now, Jordan Pickford's done that. He's gone, and he's gone full out, and Pogba's penalty wasn't right in the corner. It was ever so slightly central, which meant that Pickford had to reach back on himself. And by doing that, he couldn't get the ball into a good area and was only able to parry it back to Pogba, who got the rebound. A key thing with the penalty save, and again, for goalkeepers listening, he waited. Pogba does that ridiculous run-up, you know, absolutely ridiculous. But what Pogba is doing is he's watching the goalkeeper the whole way. Now, I've come up against a few penalty takers who are very good at this. Heider Helgeson was a good example. Eric Cantona was a good example. I didn't come across Eric Cantona, unfortunately. Ronaldo, I did come across. He does it as well, where watching the goalkeepers as long as they can. Now, if the goalkeeper goes too early, players are too good now. If the goalkeeper goes too early, players will go the other way, and they can wait until the very last moment to do it. Pogba tried to do it today. He's waited until the last moment. As soon as he's then looked down at the ball, Pickford then moved. So that's the reason that Pickford was able to go the right way. Had Pickford moved slightly too early, Pogba would have seen it and he would have put it the other way. The key is that you just need to know, again, depending on who you're coming up against. If you're coming up against an Alan Shearer from the past, he always went the same way or near enough, to, you know, 9 times out of 10. So you'd hedge your bets and you would go early and you would dive full out. If you're coming up against a Paul Pogba, I suggest you wait until the very last second and then you dive. And as today showed, if he's waiting for the goalkeeper and the goalkeeper doesn't move, the default penalty is to hook it because it's hard to open up your body last minute. So you're going to hook it into the corner. And I was taught this by Heider Helgeson, who, if anyone's Google a Heider Helgeson penalty, it's brilliant. You just roll it in so slowly. But he scored every single one. But he told me the default penalty is that then you hook it into the corner. So if you're right-footed, you put it into the left-hand side. If you're left-footed, you put it into the right-hand side because it's easier to drag it across than it is to open your body. Now, by knowing that information, if you know who you're coming up against and you know they're the type of taker that's going to wait for you to move, you need to wait pretty much until the ball is kicked. But the chances are it won't go right in the corner because it's a harder technique if he's having to wait for the keeper to then execute it and get it right in the corner. So if you do wait till it's kicked, you'll still have a great chance of making the save.
Okay, we're just going to look at some new rules that IFAB, the International FA Board, have looked to introduce this week. There's the whole passing to players inside the goal area. This is quite an archaic thing, right? I'm just going to read out Law 16 from the FA, the goal kick, right? The ball must be stationary and is kicked from any point within the goal area by a player of the defending team. The ball is in play when it leaves the penalty area. Opponents must be outside the penalty area until the ball is in play. That's looking to change.
Mm. And I agree. The only thing I can think of, and I remember being a kid, and anyone that's mid-30s or older, they'll remember this. Back in the day, especially when I was younger, I wasn't particularly good at kicking a ball, and some would argue that that continued. But when I was younger, I wasn't particularly good at kicking the ball. So what I'd look to do was I'd look to play it to one of my defenders. They'd play it back to me and I could pick it up, which before the back pass rule came in, for those that watch old games of football from years ago, teams would kill a game like that. They'd look to keep playing it back to the goalkeeper at every opportunity. You mentioned one off air about the 1990 FA Cup final.
Yeah, I mean, we're going back some way.
I was actually there. Lee Martin, 1-0. But I remember, and it would be to kill a game, you just fire it back to your goalkeeper and he'd pick it up. And then you do the same thing over and over and over until you kill the game. Hence why the back pass rule came in. I also think that might be related to this, because goal kicks, you play it out to a fullback, he'd play it back, you pick it up. And as a kid, it was a lot easier to kick it from my hands than to kick it from a goal kick. So that was a tactic that we employed, was to try and get it back into my hands and every throw it back to me so I could pick it up and then I could kick it upfield. So I do think it might be related to that, which if it is, it's pointless now. You know, it does make sense to change this rule, because how many times do teams almost do it on purpose where they'll take a goal kick, the defender will touch it while he's in the area, and then they have to take the goal kick again and they'll look like they're really disappointed. They've just wasted another minute by doing something they know they can't do.
For the first time on Goalkeepers Union, we are going to have a little glove review, mate. Are you excited?
Oh, thrilled.
Now, these are an interesting pair. They're from Attack Sports. The key thing here is that they are the pioneers of the Gaelic glove. Mm. Just going to read what it says on the side. Compression lycra backhand for skin tight fitting. The whole point of them is that they're super lightweight and durable. Very, very little padding. What do you make of them?
Yeah, I really like them, if I'm honest. I think gloves are going more and more this way. You think back to the... and there was a few brands that did a wrapper, which is what it was called, which was quite a thick glove. And in fact, it's what I wore for the majority of my career. And goalkeeper gloves were very, very bulky. Now, what we're seeing, similarly, kits. If you remember back in the day, kits were so baggy. Whereas now, everything seems to be quite tight-fitting. Certainly with these gloves, they're very tight-fitting. They're very thin. They allow a lot of flexibility in the fingers. You get a lot more feel of a football in a glove like this. So I certainly love the fact that gloves are going more in this direction, where they really... you can really feel the football, and you haven't got that sort of 5 or 6 millimeters of latex between you and the ball. I'm certainly a big fan. I haven't had a chance to wear them in a game, of course, but the actual idea, I think, is very good. We're seeing it with a lot of the top brands now. They're going more and more in this direction, and I think goalkeepers are going more and more in this direction too. The gloves are certainly becoming less bulky, and this is taking it to another level when it comes to tight fitting and a very thin glove.
Are we going a bit too far with aesthetics here? Because they are so thin. There's zero padding on them whatsoever. Now, I remember the finger savers, you know, when they came out, they were huge. You wouldn't even be able to feel the finger because it's this massive, almost like what you get with a toe cap on your feet. It was like that with your fingers. So they're so thin. Is that not protective enough of the hand?
I mean, that would be the only argument. And speaking from someone who's broken 3 of my 10 fingers, goalkeepers do break fingers, you know, and I don't know if the thicker gloves necessarily help with that anyway. You know, I remember having the finger saves that you talk about as a kid, and they were quite revolutionary at the time. And the great thing about them was that your fingers couldn't bend back, which reduced injury, but it also meant that you become a bit lazy. Balls could be shot, and you knew that you almost just needed to put your hands there, and it wasn't going to go through your hands because you had a real solid, bulky pair of gloves on. But you didn't really have any feel of the football, so you would fumble the ball more often than not because you didn't have that feel. That's why I love the fact that they're going this way a little bit more. And for kids in particular, they're then having to build the skills needed to be a top goalkeeper and not just rely on a pair of gloves just to stop the ball. So this is going to improve technique, improve skill. And I actually do believe it will improve performance, because the better that the goalkeeper gets in regards to the feel of the ball and their technique with the football, I think they'll be able to take their game to another level with a glove like this. Not necessarily this glove, but a glove that is tight-fitting and that little bit thinner.
I have to say as well, those promo images of Alisson when he signed for Liverpool in those black gloves, they do look so good,
yeah.
Don't they?
They do, and I, you know, look, everyone's got different thoughts on this. I know that, I'll give an example, if you're going to go for a night out, you want to look as good as you can possibly look. It's just a natural human want to to look the best you can look in any given situation. It's the same for footballers. Of course, they wear their matching boots and matching gloves. How many times do we see that now, that majority of keepers have matching boots, matching gloves, because it looks good? I had it at Brentford. I'll always remember, and that was actually, it sounds ridiculous, but my season changed when I bought a brand new pair of boots, gloves to match. I went out and I actually just felt like a different keeper. I had a couple of poor games and I was wearing some old boots, old gloves. I just didn't feel the part. And it does, it makes a real difference mentally to go out and actually feel confident in what it is that you're wearing.
Oh, keeper capers.
Okay, keeper capers. Now, we know every goalkeeper likes to keep a clean sheet. Not the best when it goes in the final minutes of the game, especially when you let in an absolute howler like Forest Green's Robert Sanchez did, Rich.
Yeah, unfortunately, he is our pick this week for keeper capers. And it's very reminiscent for anyone that remembers the Peter Enkelman one that went under his foot.
Aston Villa Birmingham, yeah.
Villa Birmingham. It's kind of similar to that. Aaron Martins had got the ball for Exeter in his own half and he's punted it forward to nobody in the end, going through to Sanchez. Sanchez obviously trying to waste a bit of time, went to control the ball in order to kill a few seconds. They were 2-0 up at the time. Unfortunately, it did go under his foot into the goal. Thankfully for him, they still went on to win the game 2-1, but not a particularly nice moment. Interestingly, he is a goalkeeper who's got a huge future ahead of him. He's only young, Brighton, on loan to Forest Green, a lot being made of him. In fact, I know from a few people that know him well, they think he is going to go all the way and be a top Premier League goalkeeper, but he's certainly going to have to learn from moments like this.
There is the goalkeepers' union right there. Absolute howler, but he's going to be a world beater.
Absolutely. Learn from your mistakes, keep improving.
Did you ever do anything like that in your career, mate?
Not like that. I had obviously plenty of bad moments. One that I always remember as a kid was just a clearance that had no pressure on me, really, and I've cleared it, and it's hit the striker who wasn't looking in the back of the head and gone back and gone in the goal. And I'll always remember that one as one of those moments of, like, what have I done? You know, and it's the annoying thing is, the second it happens, it's happened. There's absolutely nothing you can do, which any goalkeeper that's listening, we've all been in that position. It's a horrible feeling the moment it happens because you can't do anything. It's gone. But the key thing is, and this is the case for Robert Sanchez, is how quickly can you bounce back? The very best, they bounce back in the very next game. I know we mentioned Ben Foster a lot, and I'm going to touch on him one more time this show, because that for me was key. I'll always remember the mistake he made against Paul Robinson. Paul Robinson scored against him. The other goalkeeper scored against him. He came in after the game and he was smiling. He was laughing about it. It didn't upset him. The very next game, he went and he got man of the match. You can't change what's already happened in the past, but you can change the future. You just need to have the right mindset and continually learn, continually develop.
If you want to tune in with Philosophy 101 with Richard Lee next week, we will happily take your calls. Wonderful. And to be fair, I would like to think they didn't lose the game. That's the key thing. You'd like to think he probably got hammered a bit in the changing room for that, went on the offensive a little bit with a bit of banter, and it'll be forgotten.
It's the best way to deal with it. And I hope that's exactly what happened. And I'll be keeping an eye out for his next game, because this is now where we see what kind of a character he is. Yes, he's being highly thought of and everyone's speaking about him. How big of a character are you? Can you bounce back? Can you make sure that the next game is a very solid one?
Oh, keeper capers.
So we're delighted to have a goalkeeping legend on the line, Mr. Andy Dibble. Hi, Andy.
Good evening. Lovely to talk to you this evening.
Great to have you on the show. Look, we're going to start with the League Cup, because it's the League Cup this week. So we'll start where it pretty much all started for you, Luton Town v Arsenal. 1988, you saved a penalty and the rest is history.
From a personal point of view, a fantastic day from the club's point of view, even better for a club at that time that was, how can I say, always featuring in the old First Division, which would be the Premier League now, where we, during that time, we had a good couple of seasons where we finished in the top half of the table. But for a club of that size to go to Wembley and bring home a big trophy, in those days, obviously, that cup was valued very, very highly. I'm not saying it isn't now, but it was a full house at Wembley on the day and a brilliant achievement.
It's quite funny watching that back, Andy, because you saved that penalty and Brian Moore was almost matter of fact about the fact you'd saved it. But it seemed from watching it that not many players actually came up to you or ran around you, and it sort of went off for a corner. Next move happened and then Luton went up the other end about, I don't know, 5 minutes later and equalised.
I think in those days, and how can I say, it was a little bit more old school, and I think there was there wasn't much time on the clock, and I think probably we realised that if we got the ball up the other end, we'd have a chance of winning it. It was like as if, you know, the sun on the day was shining on us and God was wanting us to win the game. So, plus we'd had the heartache of losing the FA Cup semi-final. And everything seemed to happen so quickly from that moment onwards. And then 14, 15 minutes later, we'd won the game.
You were at a time at Luton. Obviously, you had Luton, QPR for a bit, Oldham. All had those plastic pitches. What was it like for a keeper diving around on those week in, week out?
Well, I can honestly say I really enjoyed it because we played top some top-class football on there. But hopefully I can make you laugh now if I look at my body. My knee's not in the best of state. and I mean that honestly. Everybody says to me, "Well, that knee of yours doesn't look great." And I said, "Well, you know, that's not having a go at the hierarchy that brought the plastic pitches in." But I can honestly say it caused me tenfold problems with my knee and my elbow as well. So during that time, I did enjoy it. But and Richard will back me up from the goalkeeping point of view. It was it wasn't great because of the injuries that were sustained from it.
Do you know what, it is interesting you say that because we had exactly the same. I remember going as an 11-year-old, Watford used to train. It was a place called Woodside, and it was before 3G, 4G. It was the old school hockey pitches, and they were so hard. And you don't really think about it, and you're diving around, but exactly the same thing. Knees, elbows, shoulders, the battering that they took. It's amazing to think that we were diving on those kind of pitches not so long ago.
Well, if I look at what goes on today, and they've vastly improved. I mean, at Cardiff City, sometimes, obviously, we have bad weather down in Cardiff, like everywhere else in the country. And now we have the best of, I think it's 4G pitches, but professional footballers of this day and age do not really want to train on it.
Andy, we talk about calibre of pitches. Like you said, you talk about your knees and all the rest of it. I mean, you were actually involved in probably one of the most bizarre incidents in football when you were at Barry Town with the was it chemical burns? Is that what you sustained?
Yeah, it was later on in my career. It was an interesting time because at that stage I wanted to go and play in America, and I had a kind of a deal almost all sorted in America with two or three different clubs that were interested in the time, but I didn't really want to sign for an English league club, so I signed for Barry Town on a short-term contract with the idea of just playing in the FAW Premier Cup, which was all on TV down in Wales. I played all them in all those games against the likes of Newport County, Swansea City. And they asked me to play my last game against Carmarthen, which I decided to go ahead and play in it. And I ended up getting horrific burns on my skin.
Staggering, just from the line markings on the pitch?
From the line markings on the pitch, yeah. It was found out in the end to be caustic soda.
Wow.
Another moment I want to talk to you about, Dibs, was, and it was actually one of my earliest memories of you, and one of the reasons being my best friend at the time, big Man City fan, and of course there was that moment, the Gary Crosby incident, which was hugely controversial at the time when he headed the ball out of your single hand and scored the goal. I mean, I'm interested in the moment itself, but I'm also interested in how you dealt with that, because, you know, I know myself, having been involved in big moments, how you can take it away with you and how it can eat away at you. Did you deal with that pretty well, or was it something that stayed on your mind for a while?
Personally, I felt as if I dealt with it very well. I mean, as you can imagine, as goalkeepers and now as coaches, we don't always have a great night's sleep. We always think about what goes on through the 90 minutes. Mm. That night wasn't a fantastic night in bed because obviously it was flashing through my mind all evening. I'm sure you've been through it yourself. And I did feel kind of cheated is the word, over the incident. I don't like using words like that because it's a professional sport. I did feel that, and the next season, the game changed. However, I did keep my place in the Man City first team. Obviously, Howard Kendall, God bless him, who's not with us any longer, it was manager at the time. I felt as if it cost me my place the following season when they brought Tony Cote in, who's also become a good pal of mine. And I had a really good season that year. You know, it didn't seem like a goalkeeping catastrophe. All it was, you know, I was a laughing stock of goalkeepers that season.
It was, do you know what, it was bizarre, and I 100% agree with what you're saying, because it wasn't, as you mentioned, it's not a goalkeeping mistake. And it's often these kind of things where it's a first of its kind, and then things change on the back of it. You know, you often see, was it Thierry Henry did the one where the goalkeeper's gone to kick it, and it's that action between dropping the ball and kicking it, and he's tried to nick it away and score a goal, and then they made it clear that no, that is part of a goalkeeper's action. You know, that you can't do that, otherwise it would ruin the game. If you've got strikers forever stood on a goalkeeper, and obviously over time the rules have improved, but it was one of those major moments that has changed so much for goalkeepers since.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody learned from that. And funnily enough, I bump into Roger Gifford regularly now, who's an assessor. I think he's still or involved with the Refereeing Association. I've seen him regularly. I think I look at him and he sometimes looks embarrassed when he has to talk to me about it. It certainly changed things, and things have moved on, rightly or wrongly, but it's no different to the tackling situation. But at the time, I was at the end of the season. I was very, very disappointed. And the Thierry Henry incident, as you said, that goal didn't stand. So we've moved on.
We're going to move on to Rangers now, Andy. March 1997, you came in emergency recruitment because Andy Gorham had to step out through injury. Old Firm derby, first game. Talk to us about that.
It was quite unique that evening as well, really. There's always, when I look back, there's always been big occasions, big things that have happened. But that night, the one thing I can remember about that was I had my family with me and my two young children with me and my wife. And they were very young, one and 3 years of age. On the evening of that game, the alarm went off in the hotel.
Oh, no.
Everybody had to be outside the hotel. There was a fire alarm at 4 o'clock in the morning. The Rangers team was staying there. The management, everybody was in the hotel. And I was outside with my two kids and my wife. So there was lack of sleep that night. And then I turned up at the game and found out I was playing. So sometimes it proves that you don't always need a perfect preparation to don't keep the clean sheet and win an Old Firm game in front of over 50,000.
And Divs, did I read that you got a tattoo at the end of the season in relation to that season?
Yeah, the tattoo ended up in a bit of fun in Canada. The club took us away on a trip, and it was touch and go whether Andy Gorham was going to come back. And Walter Smith had said to me, if Andy Gorham doesn't come back, because he was out of contract, there was going to be a contract offer on the table for myself. Mm. And it didn't happen, and we ended up having a few beers and playing a game of spoof. And they said, if you don't come back, you need to have a nine in a row tattoo. And I'm totally against tattoos. Lost the bet and ended up having a nine in a row tattoo that you can never read. It just looks like a blot of blue ink.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, I retired at 32, and we spoke earlier about the body taking a battering, certainly from those plastic pitches, which, you know, you were playing in a time where the facilities were nowhere near as good as they are now, yet you played until the age of 40, 18 different clubs. I mean, how did you go on for so long?
Probably just the enjoyment and loving being a goalkeeper, everything about it, really. And I think it's taken me into my next progression as a goalkeeping coach, and which I think helps, you know, the people I've worked with now, seeing the ups and downs, and just, I think, sheer determination, Rich, to be honest. And it's a big thing as a goalkeeper to get over the ups and downs. You have your good times, your bad times. I'd like to think your good times outweigh your bad times, because everybody's creative. When you look at the top goalkeepers, it isn't always a fantastic time. They have to take the rough with the smooth.
I want to move it on now, talk a bit about what you're doing now. I mean, you mentioned the fact that you had the highs and lows which, in my opinion, that puts you in the perfect position to be a top-quality goalkeeper coach, able to pass on those learnings, but also sharing the experience that your goalkeepers are going through. And obviously, the goalkeeper that you've been working with, well, his career has just gone to a massive level now. Bearing in mind, and I know quite a bit about Neil Etheridge and where he's been, obviously with Fulham for so long, had to go to Walsall in order to get regular football in League One, and has built his way up, and he's now a Premier League goalkeeper and making quite a name for himself. Obviously, two penalties in the first two games that he saved, and he's done an excellent job so far. How have you felt working with Neil? He's obviously really kicked on under your guidance.
Neil's always been an interesting one for me. A late developer, a big lad, you know, lots of attributes. Obviously, we have to work on the positives and the negatives, like we do with all our goalkeepers. But he's really taken to it, and I'm delighted with his progress. And yes, things haven't been easy for him. And you have to, at every club, you know, look, the budget comes into it. At the time, Neil was affordable. He's grown with the club, and obviously, he's getting better, and he's going to go on to better things.
Hmm. And of course, you brought in Alex Smithies to compete with him at the start of the season, which I guess is credit to Neil Etheridge that he's been able to resist that challenge. But it must be great for you as well to be able to work with someone like Alex Smithies, who's had such a good career at both QPR and Huddersfield.
You've knocked the nail on the head there, because excuse me, Alex Smithies has been a fantastic goalkeeper at QPR. I know, and I'm convinced he can play at the highest level. It was, in pre-season, they were both battling it out. Neil probably just shaded it on what he'd done last season. That was not detrimental to Alex. And Alex Smithies' time will come, I'm sure. But, you know, you've got to credit Neil Etheridge for holding down the shirt that he's made his own. But the competition is very, very healthy. I mean, I would say on Alex's part, he picked up a shoulder injury in the Carabao Cup game and probably missed a month. So he's still slightly behind. But, you know, he's still obviously very, very highly rated at the football club. And it just shows you that, you know, we have to go out and pay money for Alex Smithies. We're, in the Neil Etheridge case, we picked him up for free. But we have to obviously get another goalkeeper and spend money being in the Premier League.
Great. Well, Andy, look, thanks very much for joining us today. Some great stories there.
Thanks, guys. Lovely to talk to you.
Okay, well, this was Goalkeepers Union. Thank you very much again for listening. Do not forget, this is in association with GK Icon. All your goalkeeping needs for the next generation. Until next week, I've been Matt Beadle. It's goodbye from me.
And I've been Richard Lee. It's goodbye from me.